Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a conversation with comedian Hari Kondabolu. I'll talk with him about his new documentary, The Problem with Apu. The Apu he's talking about is the Indian convenience store owner on The Simpsons. But first, we all know that genes, for the most part, dictate what we look like, eye color, height, etc. But what about our activity level? That's the question kinesiologist Tim Lightfoot has been asking. He is the director of the Huffness Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance at Texas A&M, and he'll be speaking at Iowa State University this evening in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 7 p.m. He is with me now. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Charity. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
How did this research begin? What was the question that you started asking?
Well, for many years, colleagues of mine and I had watched the amount of physical activity that people do in the United States, and there are a variety of different questionnaires and surveys that are done on the national level. And what was interesting is that for 30 or so years that there hadn't been a change really in that number. And we started asking ourselves, are there other things that people aren't thinking about that may be influencing people's activity? And being an exercise physiologist, of course, we think about biology, and most traits and behaviors, they have some type of biological or genetic component. And we started to ask ourselves, was there a genetic factor? And I think many people would say, well, if you ask people, do genetics control activity, they would say, no, I control how much activity I do. And usually I always ask them the question, do you know people in your life that can't sit still? Or do you know people that can't get up off the couch? And the answer has always been yes. So people have a sense that there is something that helps control activity that maybe they don't have that much control over.
Well, and I think we're all comfortable with the idea when you look at someone who, say, was an amazing athlete in their prime, they have children, you think, oh, they're probably going to be athletic. So we think about the genetics in terms of predisposing somebody toward athleticism.
That's correct, yeah. But this is a little bit slightly different behavior in that we were just looking at whether or not people would be active, or, you know, whether they were active or not, as opposed to athletic capabilities or endurance or resistance training or so forth.
So how did you go about answering that question?
Well, there's a couple of different ways you can do this in the genetics world. You can certainly use human models. Those are a little bit limited because you can only go so far with that, and there are people that have taken that. We have, over the years, in conjunction with some other folks, we've developed some animal models. We look primarily at mice. And the great thing about using mice is that we can translate those genetic results to humans actually quite easily, because about 90% of the mouse genome is the same as a human genome. So we find a gene in the mouse that works a certain way, more than likely it's going to work the same way in humans. And we've done some translation studies, again, with some of the folks that do the big human studies. And so part of my talk tonight is to illustrate both the studies that have been done in humans and the studies that have been done in animals that actually support each other very well. So actually the story is pretty much the same whether you look at both animals, whether you look at either animals or humans. And that is, and we'll give away part of the punchline here, is that somewhere between 40 to 70% of your daily activity as an adult is controlled by your genetic architecture.
Interesting. So when you say that 40 to 70% is determined by our genetics, I mean, mm-hmm. you're not saying that if you are predisposed to be less active, that you are destined to be less active. I mean, let's be careful about what that means.
That's correct. Yeah. And I appreciate you bringing up that distinction, because that's also a big point that we make. You know, if it was 100% genetic, we would say it was a predestiny. But since anything less than that is a predisposition, and certainly you can overcome that. And there certainly are environmental factors that can help people become more active. And we have looked at some of those as well. There are things like family support, peer support. Diet actually can change your activity levels. Environmental toxicants can change your activity levels. So certainly when we say 40 to 70%, that certainly is a predisposition, not a predestination. So even if you have a disposition to lay on the couch, that doesn't mean that you're going to do that regardless of anything else you do. So yeah, you do have some control, and I don't want people thinking that you don't have control. Yeah, but you do have some control, but we also need to appreciate, because so often, at least when I was trained, so often it was thought that we had all of the control, and we have to understand that there is some biological control over that we don't have much of.
And when you're talking about activity, what kinds of activity are you talking about? Because, again, it's not just about working out or exercising.
That's correct. Yeah, and we're talking, actually, we use the broadest operational definition that we can, and that is basically any type of movement. And that can be whether or not you're, inclined to vacuum your house three times a day or go out and work in the garden, if you do that preferentially. That's any kind of voluntary movement is what we're talking about. So it's a very broad tent that we apply just for that reason.
All right. And let's talk about when someone has that predisposition to be less active. I mean, what is the impact of that?
Well, there certainly is both health impact on the individual. Certainly we know that if someone is less active, they are more likely to be unhealthy. And there's a whole line of diseases, chronic conditions that an individual can suffer from. What's interesting is people don't realize that if you are moderately active, at least 30 minutes a day for 5 days a week, it reduces your chance in females of breast cancer by about 24%. In males, prostate cancer, about the same amount. And so a reduction in heart disease, stroke, there's a 60% less chance of having cognitive disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's as you age if you're moderately active. We know from a health standpoint, on an individual standpoint, that being healthy is very good for people. What people also don't understand is that from an economic perspective, being active or being inactive actually cost our healthcare systems quite a bit. The estimates range a bit. One of the largest estimates out there was done in 2006 that suggested that the annual cost to healthcare in the United States is about $506 billion from physical inactivity, because physical inactivity is involved in so many conditions such as obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease. All these things are partially ascribed to physical inactivity.
Now, we have a lot of concerns about childhood obesity in
yes,
the United States.
Yes.
That's been rising for many years. But your study did not focus on kids.
Yeah, our studies normally do not focus on kids. There is a whole host of literature that does focus on kids. Actually, there's a group in Europe that's all they look at is the genetic and biological determinants of physical activity in kids. And what they find in kids is that up until the age of independence, and so we're looking at somewhere between 16 or 18 years of age, activity patterns in children are mostly due to their unique environmental situation, and that means the support of their parents, maybe what their friends do, what they see in schools. So those kind of environmental influences are huge in a kid's life. Until they become at the age of independence, and then that's when their genetics starts to ramp up and exert more control over how active they are.
Interesting. So the environment of the family, peer pressure, sports they might be involved in, that's all more influential than this predisposition.
Yes. As a child. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, one of the things that we're finding is that one of the big factors may be the diet they eat. We have some data that's been published recently that shows that if you put, in our case, again, younger animals, because we can easily manipulate this, if you put them on a high-fat, high-sugar diet, very similar to what we eat here in the United States in general, that activity levels decrease by about 65%. And there are some physiological mechanisms associated with that. And that's been seen not only in our mice, but I have a friend of mine that does work in baboons, and they've seen that in baboons as well. And so when we think about what we feed our children, we have to make sure that we feed them a healthy diet so that doesn't influence their activity levels.
Now, I think this question is so interesting because of our fitness culture in the United States. I mean, a lot of us, of course, seek to be more fit, maybe try to start a new workout program, maybe look to a physical trainer. When someone who is out of shape approaches someone who's in the fitness industry and, says, hey, I want to get in shape, it feels like often there's this really big disconnect between the trainer or the kinesiologist or, whoever is on the fitness side and the person who's really struggling with that. Do you feel like maybe there's a predisposition among many people who go into fitness fields to be on that more active end, and maybe a lack of understanding of the other side.
Well, and absolutely. And I know that's one of the things that, as I've worked with students over the last 28, 29 years in this business, and I know as they do here at Iowa State in their Department of Kinesiology, one of the things you have to work with the students is to help them empathize with the people that are coming in that may be coming at it from a different perspective as you do. A good friend of mine was the director of the YMCA in another large metropolitan area, and one of the initiatives they had was for those people who were not inclined to exercise, because he told me several times, he said, Tim, the people that work in this facility and the people that come in on a regular basis, they're that 10% that are already active anyway. We've captured them. We're really concerned about the 90% that don't come in. And I think that's what the educational systems like what you have at Iowa State and what we have at Texas A&M, that's what we continue to emphasize to our students, is to look past themselves and their own understandings of how they came to exercise, and to try to empathize with the people that are coming in and sitting with them and going through their goals and aspirations for exercise. Because, again, these people, as you said, may be coming at it from a different standpoint in their life.
Well, and it's interesting you talk about the 10% that are doing this, the 90% that aren't. I guess when we think about genetic predisposition, I don't know, in my brain I'm thinking, oh, 50% are more active, 50% are less active. How does it break down? Do we know, are humans more inclined to be less active than more active?
Yeah, it's great that you asked that question. There have been a couple of large-scale studies in the United States where they've actually put accelerometers on people and actually been able to measure their activity. Up until about the mid-2000s or so, most of the time that kind of data came from questionnaires where people would call you up and say, are you active or have you been active or something general like that. And so you got yes, no, and those weren't really good questions. And actually there's a professor here at Iowa State, Dr. Welk, who's an expert in this area. And one of the things he would tell you is that, especially in like 2008, there was a large-scale study that was published in the United States, that they followed 8,000 people, age ranges, I believe, from 6 to 65 or 70 or so, with accelerometers on them. And what they found, amazingly, was that only about 2.5% to 3.5% of the population above the age 18 actually met physical activity, healthy physical activity standards, or about 20 to 30 minutes of activity a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking right now with Tim Lightfoot. He's a kinesiologist, the director of the Huffinus Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance at Texas A&M. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University tonight in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 7 p.m. His talk is called Can You Be Born to a Couch Potato? That's tonight at 7. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with comedian Hari Kondabolu. We'll talk about his new documentary, The Problem with Apu. He'll be performing in Iowa City this week. Right now, we're talking about our genetics and how they may influence our activity level. Kinesiologist Tim Lightfoot is with me. He's the director of the Huffinus Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance at Texas A&M. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union tonight at 7 p.m. His talk is Can You Be Born a Couch Potato? The Genetics of Physical Activity. And Tim, just before the break, we were talking about how inactive modern humans are, and really some striking statistics about how few people really do get even that 30 minutes a day of exercise 5 days a week, sort of that minimum recommendation. Do you think that this is part of our evolution, that maybe we evolved to conserve energy and to be inactive when we can be inactive?
Yeah, that's a great point, and that's been brought up many times. And actually, there's some literature from the 50s and 60s from anthropologists who studied hunter-gatherer societies in Africa and in South America, and they have made that conclusion. And to some extent, if you think about it from a limited food supply, it doesn't make sense to be active when you don't need to be active. And so that has caused quite a bit of discussion in the field that I work in about why would we have evolved these kind of mechanisms. And that's one of the reasons that we started looking at food as a potential driver. It's fairly well known in our field and in several fields of physiology that if you want to make an individual active, and that's a human as well as animals, you just decrease their food a little bit. So if you decrease the caloric intake by about 10% to 12%, that activity goes up quite a bit. And it's been thought that that's a mechanism that's built in our bodies to help us find food, makes us more active to find food.
And it seems a little counterintuitive.
It does. And to a certain extent, if you go too far, too much caloric restriction, like if you start to starve someone, they run out of energy and they can't be active. That is correct. But if you start to run, if you do start to run out of food, and again, you have a moderate food reduction, then that stimulates some mechanisms in the brain in particular that causes you to be active to find food. And we've seen that in animals. And so we started out asking the reverse question, that is, if food is easy to find and you overfeed humans and you overfeed animals, what would happen? And as I mentioned earlier, we see a marked decrease in activity in these animals when you overfeed them and you give them high fructose, high fat diets. It's been suggested in humans the same thing happens. There's a little bit of data on that, on both sides of this. And so it's interesting that evolutionarily, if we have lost the need to go find food, then perhaps we've lost the need to be as active as we have been in the past. Certainly, we have more labor-saving devices. There's a lot fewer jobs now that require manual labor. And so there's another factor that's also decreased the general amount of activity in our life. So it's a very interesting question. It's one that we've written a couple papers on about what is the future of human activity if it's going this direction. And so it's a fun topic to talk about. But again, I think in the long term, we will only know the answer to that in the long term.
Well, and of course, in addition to how our modern diets have changed, how our modern employment has changed,
yep.
our modern yep. entertainment has also changed, where there are so many draws to
yep.
remain still.
You're absolutely right. And so to some extent, getting people to get up and be active and to disconnect is a difficult thing because they often find things more attractive in that virtual world than they do outside, which is a bit of a shame because we have, you know, especially a wonderful fall right now. So it's great to get out and look at that.
So I want to talk to you about ways to overcome this
yes.
predisposition, because I think that's the question that so many of us have, because a lot of us fight that battle on a daily basis. Also, if you want to join our conversation, please give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Earlier, I mentioned that gulf that there feels like there is between somebody who's trying to become fit and maybe somebody who works in the fitness industry or in kinesiology, someone who has researched this as part of their life. Do you feel like this is a battle that you've had to fight personally? Are you predisposed to be an active person?
I'm fairly predisposed to be active. I recently had some surgery that didn't allow me to be active for about a week and about drove me and my wife nuts. And so certainly I am predisposed to be active, but part of that I think is my environment. I also had a biological father who was very inactive and became very obese and had a lot of health problems towards the end of his life. And so that was always a motivating factor for me, was that I didn't want to be like my dad in the activity sense. It comes back to, this is a combination of factors. It's not just genetic. But it is also environment. It's the things that you see as a child and the things that strike you. And so I think the thing that parents could do most for their children is to set a great example. Parents, disconnect from the TV, disconnect from the videos, take your kids out for a walk, help them get outside. That is an impact that will resonate with them for the rest of their lives. I mean, that's just such a huge thing. And Charity, I'd come back to the point you made, and that's about fitness professionals. There are a lot of good fitness professionals out there that are very empathetic with their clients and can bring to bear some modern behavior change mechanisms. One of the things I get asked all the time about this is the so what question. So what if you find that there's a genetic predisposition, what can you do about it? We certainly can't change anybody's genes, but what we can do is, if we know that someone is predisposed to be inactive, there are some different behavior change mechanisms that we can use to help people become more active. And those are things that you just need to share with your exercise physiologist or the person, your fitness trainer, that you're working with, because they do have different strategies they can use with people to help them become more active.
So what are some of the mechanisms that you see as most successful in getting people to change their behaviors? Because a lot of people, as I mentioned, really, really do struggle with that.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different ways I can go with that. One of the things certainly that we are working on as a researcher is I'm trying to understand what are the mechanisms that are controlling this biologically, with the hope that somewhere down the way we can actually figure out how we can do things to help people become more active naturally. Certainly that's one of the reasons that we started down the diet pathway. Are there diet metabolites in particular, if we increase the amount of tryptophan or increase the amount of dopamine that you have in your brain, will that help you? So that's certainly one way that we hope in the future that we can actually make some customized interventions for people.
So actually understanding the chemical
right
input.
Absolutely. And frankly, that's where our work has been for many years. And that's really the crux of the matter for us. It's one thing just to say, hey, there is a genetic impact. But for us, it's really explaining what is the genetic impact, what is the controlling mechanism. That's critical for us. From a more macro standpoint, when we're working with the public to help them be more active, there certainly, as I said, there's some behavior change mechanisms that can be used. One that has been somewhat controversial at times has been, do you pay people to be fit? I know there are insurance programs that will reduce premiums if you meet certain height and weight criteria, and there's been a real argument about whether or not that is actually useful or not. On a small scale, it's been shown to be pretty effective if you pay people to be active. And so there, and I'm not saying that's the case for everybody, but I'm just saying that that's the kind of strategies that have been talked about in the field. There are people trying these things out in different ways, different kinds of programs. And so I would say to your listeners, if you want to be active, if you know you need to be active, then continue to look for a program that meets your needs, that maybe has something that helps you be passionate about something. One of the things they say, if your pet's overweight, then that's the best excuse for you to take your pet for a walk. And maybe you can start to lose weight that way as well. So there's a variety of those different types of programs.
So if the intrinsic motivation isn't working for you, look for an extrinsic motivation.
Absolutely. What a great way to put it.
We're going to go to the phones now. You are welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. Kinesiologist Tim Lightfoot is here with me today. He's the director of the Huffness Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance at Texas A&M. The number to call with your questions, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mike is on the line in Fort Dodge. Hi, Mike.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I just have a question. When and I don't know if he's answered my question when I was off the air for a second, but when you're talking about a 30 minutes a day exercise, I read a lot where it's every other day, but I just was curious as to what kind of exercise for that specific 30 minutes, how strenuous and so on. That's kind of my question.
All right. I'm sure that's a question that you hear quite a bit, Tim. When we say 30 minutes of activity a day, what kind of activity are we talking about?
Well, in most cases, that 30 minutes a day is considered moderate. They'd like you to see do moderate activity. And so we're talking about something that's between 40 to 70% of your max heart rate. And there's some other ways to do it. So things that will actually make you break a bit of a sweat. We certainly don't want you, if it's hurting when you do it, we don't believe in the no pain, no gain kind of thing. That's not the way to do it. So when we think about 30 minutes a day, we're talking about moderate intensity activity. If all you can do is walk for 30 minutes, that's great. Walk for 30 minutes a day. Once you can get the 30 minutes a day, try jogging 100 yards and so forth. If we're talking about walking, running. And again, you can do that with cycling. You can do that with swimming. So much of what we've talked about in our field for the last 25 years is the thought is if we get people just active, if we can just get them out there doing that, that they will actually start to naturally progress. There are researchers here at Iowa State that actually look at what we call self-selection of intensity. Whereas what's interesting, there have been experiments where if you put people on a treadmill and you tell them just to work out, pick the speed that you want to go out, most of the time people will pick a fairly moderate intensity. And so just telling people, look, go out, work out at a moderate rate for 30 minutes a day for 5 days a week, That's what most of the guidelines are built around. That will help you. If you want to go more than 30 minutes a day, hey, we're not stopping you. Do that. That will work as well. But that kind of minimum threshold of 20 to 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, that's great.
Well, and for a long time, there was this idea that to get the maximum benefit out of 30 minutes a day, you needed to do it in one stretch, really maintain that elevated heart rate. What are your thoughts on that today? Does it matter if it's 10 minutes at a time, or does it need to be a concerted effort?
No, it's an accumulation per day. So again, if you can only, and we often work with chronic disease populations that way, you get them started, and if they can go 5 minutes, then you have them do that six times a day. So you get that 30 minutes a day in. And what's interesting is that people start doing that, they start going longer and longer and longer. The human body is amazing because it's one of the few mechanical mechanisms that we know that get better with use. And so I encourage people, do what you can do. If you can do 30 minutes at a time, that is great. Then start working on that intensity. But if you have to do it in 10-minute blocks, if that's all the time you have, that's great too. We just want you to accumulate that.
We have a lot of emphasis in our culture on weight and weight loss when we talk about fitness activities. How do you like to measure fitness?
Oh, that's a multi-threaded question. That's really the $4 million question, isn't it, Charity? Fitness is generally defined as the ability to do physical tasks without undue stress, maybe even unexpected physical tasks, and that's kind of more of a technical definition. We want people to go out and to be fit so they can do things. They can play with their grandchildren. They can play with their children. They can go out and visit with friends. That's kind of my operational definition is I want people to be comfortable with their life and don't feel like their physical limitations stop them from doing anything in their life. I had an orthopedic surgeon once say to me before surgery, he said, you know, you can either fix your lifestyle to fit your current physical state, or you can fix your physical state to fit the lifestyle that you want. And so that's what I tell people is that we want to fix your physical state so that can fit the lifestyle that you want, not the lifestyle that you're forced to have.
Do you feel like we overemphasize weight when we think about fitness? Does that get in some people's way of actually becoming more fit because they're focusing on losing weight?
Well, and I think weight is certainly an interesting, a very important factor. It's the cause of so many things, and I think I think you're right. We do emphasize weight sometimes too much. Exercise in and of itself is not a wonderful way to reduce weight. You can do that, of course, but it's also a combination of proper diet that goes in there. So it's really two things. It's hand in hand. Certainly exercise is a great way to maintain a good weight. And so I think all these conversations kind of all get mixed up. And the critical thing for us is, at least for me professionally, is to get people active. And if we can get them active and we can keep them active, then usually the other items take care of themselves. Weight starts to come off. They start to feel better. They want to do it more. And it's really a cycle, a very positive cycle in people.
Let's go back to the phone. Sarah is on the line in Marion. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a lot of the same problems as your guest mentions. Just like, you know, it feels so good to sit on the couch, and I don't always have the time to get out and exercise, but I started hiking recently, and I actually got into identifying all the things I'd seen around me before, plants and fungi and even animals, and it suddenly became so much more interesting for me to go out and exercise. And I actually started foraging too, you know, like simple stuff like blackberries and mulberries and also things like oyster mushrooms. And so that actually put a big change in my diet as well, and I started enjoying those things more. And it was always just really the motivation that killed exercise for me. I can't just sit on the treadmill forever. I can barely even walk up a flight of stairs when I'm, going to class. But when I'm hiking and I have a goal and an interest, I don't even notice it. It's just that really that motivation that holds me back.
So you found something you love after, it sounds like, looking for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm surprised I didn't start to do it sooner because I've always been really interested in nature and stuff, but I've only recently had sort of the independence to go out and do it on my own, especially, you know, like I first took pepper spray with me because I wasn't sure what I would encounter just hiking on my own, but really it's been very nice, and I've met a ton of nice people too that are actually interested in what I'm doing and especially what I'm foraging too.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so much for sharing. And Tim, that's got to be one of your favorite things to hear, is when somebody says, hey, it turns out I actually like getting exercise. I found something I like to do.
Absolutely. And congratulations to Sarah. But that comes back to the key thing about being active, and that's find what you're passionate about. Find something that excites you, some activity that excites you. Again, if it's just gardening, that's fine. You're out. You're being active. If you decide you want to run marathons, that's great too. If you just want to hike and see nature, that's great too. People get caught up in this, well, I have to meet certain criteria, I have to meet certain guidelines, I have to go out and run a mile or whatever. That's not true. We just want you to get up and get active, because once you get up and get active, I think many people will find they do like it. It's not a punishment. It's fun. They get to learn more things about themselves and nature in this case, and they wind up doing it more often.
Well, Tim Lightfoot, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Tim Lightfoot, he is the director of the Huffness Institute for Sports Medicine and Humor Performance at Texas A&M. He is a professor of kinesiology, and he'll be speaking at Iowa State University tonight at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. His talk is Can You Be Born a Couch Potato? The Genetics of Physical Activity. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with comedian Hari Kondabolu. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.